Hi, welcome back to the channel. This video is a compilation of the best stories from the world of business and finance that I've posted over the last 7 days. If you haven't had a chance to watch all of my videos, this is the perfect place for you because you'll be able to see everything in one place. And because I split all of my videos into chapters, it's really easy to skip through things that you're maybe not that interested in or you've heard about or seen before. So if you have a look in the description below, you'll see all of the different topics that I've covered in this video, and therefore you can jump around and move to the ones that you're interested in, or alternatively, you could watch the whole video if you like. And if you are liking the content, then please give me a thumbs up at some point during this video. And don't forget to subscribe if you haven't done so already. And as always, please post some comments down below. I'm always really interested to hear what people think and what sort of stories you're interested in me posting more about. So thanks for watching, and hopefully you'll enjoy all of the best bits from the last week. Goldman Sachs have released the findings of a survey that they took amongst 1,500 small businesses in America between the 10th and the 13th of January. So quite a recent survey. And this survey was looking to see what the impact on small business was of recent events such as Omicron, the supply chain crisis, and increases in prices caused by inflation. And the overall findings of this survey are that there's been a triple whammy on all small businesses. They are being hurt by labor shortages, continuing problems with the supply chain crisis, and increased costs caused by inflation. 98% of all of the businesses surveyed said that their bottom line profits had been reduced because of the increased costs of hiring new staff and retaining existing staff. 87% of those businesses saw labor shortages as the most significant factor affecting their business in 2022. So most of these companies are struggling to hire people. A lot of people were either furloughed or released at the start of all of the COVID pandemic. And a lot of businesses are struggling to rehire those individuals, either because they don't want to go back and work in that industry, or they found some other form of employment, or they're just too expensive. 69% of the businesses surveyed said that they'd been impacted by the supply chain crisis. And 2/3 of the businesses surveyed said that they felt that suppliers were favoring large businesses over small businesses because of the volumes that they can order. So that meant that they're struggling to get hold of the materials that they need to actually produce their finished products. 37% of all of the businesses surveyed said that they had either had to close or significantly scale back their operations as a direct result of Omicron. In terms of the outlook and the confidence for the rest of 2022, 84% of businesses have concerns over inflation, 68% have concerns over the supply chain crisis, and only 73% of all businesses surveyed are optimistic about their prospects for 2022. So the results of this survey show that there are a lot of issues going on within small businesses, and small businesses are the heartbeat of every single economy. We're seeing the direct impact of increased prices and increased labor costs, and we're also seeing the impact of the supply chain crisis, which is disproportionately affecting these smaller businesses because they are being sidelined in favor of the large businesses by all of the suppliers. So this data is of concern and shows that we haven't yet seen the full impact of all of the issues that Omicron brought to us. So it's still unfolding. We're still seeing businesses not operating at their maximum capacity, and that means that they won't make the level of profits that they're expecting, and therefore we could see some business failures as we go through 2022. And as we all know, we're not out of the woods yet in terms of any future variants and any further lockdowns and implications and all of the rest of it. So this is a really interesting survey because it's easy to keep track of the big businesses because a lot of them are listed and we see their results posted on a quarterly basis. But on a smaller level, we don't see anything from all of these smaller entities. And really, we just have to get a feel for what's happening from GDP and the general economy. So what we're seeing here is a heads up that there are issues within the small business sector, and they're likely to transfer over into the general economy as we move through the rest of 2022. So interesting news from Apple this week, who released their quarterly results to the end of December. And everybody was expecting these results to be quite poor. Apple warned in October that they expected their revenues to be impacted negatively by the microchip shortage because they use those chips in all of their products. And at that time, they had warned that they expected to lose $6 billion of sales in the quarter. But as it turned out, it proved to be a blockbuster quarter for Apple. They actually achieved a record level of sales. They came in at $123.9 billion. And that compared to analyst estimates of around about $119 billion. And the main reason that they did so well is that they had a variety of new products that they launched into the festive period. So they had a new Apple Watch, new Apple AirPods, a new MacBook Pro, and a new iPad. And all of those new products were really well received by the market. And these results had a really positive effect on the Apple share price. And despite the troubles going on in the stock markets right now, the share price ended the week up 6.4% and is now trading at around about $170 per share. So a really great set of results from Apple. They remain the darling of the stock market. Everybody loves Apple and the share price is holding up despite the fact that a lot of other tech stocks have taken an absolute battering over the last week or so. Tesla announced its quarterly results to the end of December, and these results are a stark contrast to the Apple performance. Now, the financial performance was actually strong, with revenue of $17.7 billion in the quarter, compared to analysts' expectations of $16.5 billion. But the market was expecting some positive news about new models. One of the criticisms of Tesla at the moment is that it doesn't have a mid-range vehicle. The market would like to see Tesla producing a model that's priced somewhere in the mid-$20,000 range. And they were also expecting a detailed update on the Cybertruck, which is the pickup truck that Tesla has been working on, the space-age vehicle that I talked about in a previous video. On the call with investors, it was specifically stated that no new models will be released in 2022. And that's caused a disappointment in the market and caused the share price to end up over 6% down on the week. So we've seen the price come down from a recent high of $977 per share and is now trading at around about $850. And interestingly, on the call, Elon Musk spent a long time talking about the Tesla bot. In mid-2021, he announced that Tesla was working on a robot, and this was something that they see as a bigger market than cars, and he is still talking about that same bot. There have been hundreds of memes about this, and everybody thinks it's a bit of a joke, but Elon Musk thinks that it's serious and that he's going to be able to convert this into cash. However, he still seems to be a long way from bringing anything to market, and also nobody's really quite sure what you're meant to do with a Tesla bot. So the share price fell significantly on the day that these results were announced and wiped off over $109 billion from the value of Tesla. So as I said, it's a stark contrast to the Apple situation. Apple is still the darling of the stock market and over-exceeded everybody's expectations. Tesla, despite coming in with good figures, have disappointed the market because their pipeline is not as exciting. They're now talking about distracting things such as bots. And they also mentioned that they've got ongoing supply chain issues. The Beijing Olympics are due to start on Friday, the 4th of February. And there's been a very muted reaction to this in the world press. So we've seen a number of diplomats announcing that they will not be attending the Games. And there's a little bit of political tension. And a lot of the sponsors who are supporting the Games are taking a very low-key approach to it. So we're not seeing a lot of heavy advertising talking about the Olympics and everything that's coming up. So it will be interesting to see how well received the actual event is once it starts. But on the issue of China, I just wanted to touch on Evergrande. If you've seen recently, I posted a video talking about some of the suppliers to Evergrande and the other big property developers who are now starting to post significant losses. And they're also filing lawsuits against Evergrande because of non-payment of all of their invoices. So these guys have been dependent on Evergrande and the other big property developers for the last 10 years. And a lot of them have 100% of their business with Evergrande and they simply haven't been paid. And there comes a point when you have to mark that invoice as a bad debt and therefore it doesn't go through your accounts and you end up posting a loss. And a lot of these businesses are now in serious financial difficulty. And we are talking really large companies who are losing hundreds of millions of dollars, and they are employing tens and hundreds of thousands of people. So really big businesses that are starting to get into financial difficulty, we may see some of these companies go into bankruptcy and become liquidated. And therefore, we're starting to see the contagion spread through the whole of the Chinese economy. It's not just going to be contained to the property development sector. So if you want more detail on that, please check out the video that I posted recently. But I also wanted to touch on the bondholder discussions. If you've been following the channel, you'll know that Evergrande recently had a conference call with all the bondholders, and everybody was quite excited to hear what they were going to say, to hear what their proposal was. And their proposal turned out to be that they want to wait 6 months to put together a preliminary plan. So that isn't really a proposal at all. That's just wasting everybody's time and giving themselves 6 months to be able to cherry pick all the assets and move them to the state-owned enterprises. So one of the overseas bondholders, a US hedge fund called Oaktree, has actually taken some action and seized one of the properties that Evergrande owns in Hong Kong, which was reported to have a valuation of over $1 billion. So this is the first form of positive action against Evergrande that we have seen any of the debt holders taking. So it'll be interesting to see what develops, how this unfolds, and whether or not we see more action like this, whether more of the assets outside of China are seized by any of the debt holders. A quick update on Turkey. If you've been following my postings, you'll know that there is currently an energy crisis and an electricity shortage in Turkey. And all of this has been caused because a pipeline from Iran to Turkey that supplies natural gas had technical difficulties and meant that none of that gas was being supplied. And that equates to around about 16% of Turkey's total gas supplies. And Turkey announced that it was going to restrict the usage of this gas. And they told the power stations that use natural gas to create electricity that their usage was going to have to be reduced by 40%. And they told industry that they would have to cut their usage by 60%. Now, what happened after that was we actually saw a lot of electricity be switched off to the organized industrial zones, which are the places where all of the businesses in Turkey are located. So a lot of companies lost their power and they had to shut down their operation. Now, initially, it was advised that this would last for 3 to 4 days. We just heard from President Erdogan that it's now going to be another 10 to 15 days, and it might run until the 10th of February. And this is absolutely disastrous for all of those businesses. If they have to close for 2 or 3 weeks, then that could be the end of the road and bankruptcy for these companies. And also, they may lose their position in the global supply chain. And the root cause of all of the problems for Turkey right now is their lack of foreign currency. They need foreign currency to buy gas, to keep the power stations running and to keep everybody supplied with fuel for cooking, heating and industrial processes. And they don't have enough dollars. So they spent over $10 billion in December supporting the lira and buying gas. And now they only have around $7.5 billion left. So they really are at the end of the road in terms of the cash that they've got. So we're now at a really critical stage for Turkey, and they need to do something to turn this around. Otherwise, they're facing a bailout or bankruptcy. Hi, welcome back to the channel. This video is an update on the Evergrande situation, and there's been some really interesting and exciting news. So if you've been following the channel, you'll know that I've been talking for a long time about the bondholders having no chance of recovering any of their money and that they were likely to just be left out to pasture while the government moved a lot of the assets from Evergrande to the state-owned enterprises and maybe pays back some of the Chinese lenders with the residual of what's left. Well, it seems that a US hedge fund has other ideas, and an outfit called Oaktree has seized some assets in Hong Kong and also in mainland China. So in this video, I'll give you a rundown of who Oaktree are, and you may be surprised that some of your money is being managed by these guys. I'll talk about the two projects in more detail. One of them is a parcel of land in Hong Kong, and the other is an active development in China. We'll look at the issues that this throws up for Evergrande's restructuring and what the Chinese authorities' response to this has been. And then I'll finish up with a summary as to the longer term implications of this and what's likely to happen over the next 3 to 6 months. Oaktree is a US hedge fund. Now, hedge fund is a term that is used to cover a wide variety of fund managers. And Oaktree's specialism is distressed debt. It was established in 1995 by two individuals, Howard Marks and Bruce Karsh, both of whom are now billionaires and included in the Forbes billionaires list each year. Marks and Karsh have been working together at Citibank, where they've been focusing on high yield bonds, and they decided that they wanted to set up their own fund, focusing on these high yielding assets. Now, as you may be aware, if you follow my channel, high yield bonds are issued to investors by large corporates, and the coupon that is paid on these sort of bonds is much higher than for investment grade bonds, but obviously the risk is also higher. And Oaktree was set up initially to make profits on those bonds. Now, that was done in two ways, either by buying the bonds in the primary market, which means that Oaktree were buying them directly from corporates as they were issuing the bonds, and they would be taking those bonds at par. Or the other way of making money on high yield bonds is to buy them in the secondary market. And the secondary market is where you're buying a bond from an existing holder. So that bond was issued directly to the first holder, and then the first holder sells to the second holder. And the price of that bond will depend entirely upon how that company is trading. So if a company is underperforming against its original expectations, then the price of that bond will fall to less than 100 cents on the dollar. And as Oaktree was established as a distressed debt fund, it focused on picking up bonds that were trading below par and looking to create value. So they would come in and buy a bond for maybe 50 cents on the dollar, where it was expected that you'd only get back half of the original amount that was lent to that company. And Oaktree would focus on trying to get back more than 50 cents on the dollar for that purchase. So this is a very risky part of the market, because if you get it wrong, then you can lose all of your capital. But the guys at Oaktree have performed incredibly well over the last 25 years or so. And for the last 20 years, they have delivered a return of around about 19% every year to their investors. And as you would imagine, a fund that is delivering those sort of returns has been very popular with investors. And the assets under management have grown from around about $5 billion 25 years ago to over $165 billion today. And fund management is a very lucrative enterprise. As I've talked about before, fund managers on average take a management fee of around about 2% every single year. So $165 billion of assets under management means that Oaktree are being paid over $3 billion per year to manage those funds. Now, that doesn't include any profit that Oaktree are making on the actual funds themselves. That's just purely their fee that they are paid every year. So you can see why Mr. Marks and Mr. Karsh are in the billionaires list, because there's been a lot of fees paid over the last 25 years to Oaktree. And I mentioned at the start of this video that it's possible that some of your money is being managed by Oaktree. In terms of whose money Oaktree is managing, their investors include 67 of the 100 largest US pension funds, 40 of the 50 state retirement plans in the US, and over 300 endowments and foundation companies. And if we look at the split of where those funds are derived from, over 20% are from public funds, 13% from insurance companies, 11% from pensions, 10% from sovereign wealth funds, and the list goes on. And this graphic shows the offices that Oaktree has, and you can see that they are a global operator. And the interesting part for us here is that they have offices in Hong Kong, Shanghai, and Beijing. So they've actually got offices in mainland China. And because Oaktree has offices in mainland China and Hong Kong, it has been involved in lending money directly to Evergrande. Obviously, when you're a global player and you have offices everywhere, you have to do business in all of your local economies. So Oaktree is one of the long list of lenders that has been giving money to Evergrande. But the key difference with Oaktree's loans to Evergrande is that they are secured. They are direct to the company and they have some security attaching to them. Now, that is different to the high yield bonds. So the $19 billion of high yield bonds that are in the market right now are all unsecured. So the lenders and the investors in those bonds have no rights whatsoever. They can't take any direct action against any of the assets that Evergrande owns because there's no link between that debt and those assets. But what we've got here is Oaktree has security, which means that when they gave the loans to Evergrande, Evergrande signed over those assets to Oaktree in the event of a default. And this is why we've got this exciting update, because Oaktree had a direct link between their loan and some of Evergrande's assets. And they have now been taking action to seize those assets. So let's get into the detail and talk about the assets that Oaktree have now taken control of. In January 2021, Oaktree provided a loan of $520 million to Evergrande in respect of a strip of land in Hong Kong that has been referred to as Project Castle. And the reason it was referred to as Project Castle is that the founder of Evergrande wanted to build a giant mansion that was compared to the Versailles mansion created by Louis XIV of France. And if you're not familiar with that mansion, it was the epitome of everything ornate and outlandish and just a sign of immense wealth. But the giant mansion was never constructed and the land remains undeveloped. Now, I don't have the details as to why Oaktree provided the loan and what the plans were, whether or not they were still intending to create this mansion or whether they were looking to convert the project into a residential project. But as you'll know, if you follow this channel, Evergrande has been in difficulty for some time. So when they raised that loan, it may have been that they just needed capital to keep paying for some of their other projects, because it doesn't look like there's been anything started on the land in Hong Kong itself. Now, Oaktree sends regular updates to its investors on all of its activities. And one of the letters it sent out in 2021 stated that the loan to value for this particular loan was in the mid 60s. So if we assume that it was 65%, then that would give a gross value for the land of $800 million. Evergrande has subsequently defaulted on this loan, and it's just been announced that Oaktree have appointed a receiver and seized control of this land. Now, this action has reportedly really upset everybody on the risk management committee at Evergrande, because they were supposedly putting together a plan to use these assets and any other assets that Evergrande owns outside of China as part of some form of restructuring proposal for the bondholders. But unfortunately, that will no longer be possible because Oaktree is now in the process of selling this asset in order to pay back its $520 million loan. So it's really difficult to know how much this land is now worth, but safe to say that it's worth less than it was in January 2021. As we've discussed previously, there is a major slowdown in the property sector in China, and that will definitely be affecting the Hong Kong market. So this land may have had a value of $800 million over a year ago, but it's likely to be significantly less now. So whether or not Oaktree are able to sell it and whether or not they're able to raise enough money to pay off their $520 million loan remains to be seen, but it's very unlikely that there'll be any residual value. Now, the Evergrande management team have actually said that if there is any extra value, then that will be used as part of the discussions with the offshore lenders. But it seems unlikely to me that Oaktree will generate significantly more than $500 million for this land. The other asset that Oaktree has seized control of relates to a major development that Evergrande has been working on for over 10 years. Now, this development has been dubbed Venice and is located in a tourist area close to the Yellow Sea. Now, Evergrande has done what it has done in some other areas, where it's effectively created a mini city. So it's reported that Evergrande have invested $4.7 billion into this project, and they've created a 7-star hotel, 9 different major centres that cover things like business and sporting events, schools, bars, restaurants, and over 66 million square feet of residential space. Now, I've heard a great story about this development. I don't have any evidence, but I wanted to share it with you anyway. It's reported that Evergrande cordoned off a large part of the ocean that surrounds this development and dyed it a brighter colour blue because they didn't think it was impressive enough for all of the people who were coming to buy property in that area. Now, I don't know whether that's true, but if I was betting on it, I think it probably might be. But I think it's a really interesting thing for people to think about, that you've got a developer and they're not happy with the colour of the water surrounding all of the apartments. So the solution is to dye it a different colour, is to actually just throw some chemicals into that water to try and make it a bit brighter. Absolutely crazy. Anyway, Oaktree provided a loan of $400 million to Evergrande to continue developing some of this area. Now, the information that we've been provided with shows that the construction of the development was stopped at some point. And Oaktree took the really unusual course of action of seizing control of this development in mainland China. So official papers show that Raymond Chan, who's the managing director of Oaktree's Hong Kong office, has been appointed as the legal representative of this development. And we understand that Oaktree have recommenced construction and have started marketing the apartments again. So they're actually selling some of these properties. And of course, the reason Oaktree is doing this is to unlock the value that is currently tied up in these unfinished apartments. As it stood previously, there was no chance of Evergrande being repaid because the construction had stopped and therefore all the value was sitting in a depreciating asset. So Oaktree have taken some positive action. They've stepped in themselves. They're managing the construction and they will see the build through to completion and then get the sales moving and hopefully repay some of the $400 million that they are owed. So what issues do these developments throw up for Evergrande? Well, it's been really interesting to see what Oaktree have done. But the reason that they've been able to take some action is that they had some security. And that is very different to the international bonds. And also a lot of the Chinese debt is unsecured as well. So when you're looking objectively at debt, the reason that unsecured debt is so attractive to companies is that it's really difficult for lenders to do anything about it if it goes wrong. And the reason that secured debt is so attractive to a lender is that they have some assets that they can hang their hat on. They can actually do something about it. Even if the company is tanking and the management team is out of control, if you can get hold of those assets, then you've got a chance of getting repaid. And that's the situation that Oaktree are in. So they're in a much better position than anybody else in this scenario. So the action that Oaktree has taken doesn't really translate to any of the international bondholders. They're not in a position to do what Oaktree have done, even though they would like to, because they don't have any legal recourse to any of Evergrande's assets. Now, the seizure of the land in Hong Kong is not that surprising because Hong Kong is still seen as an international jurisdiction. And as the land itself was undeveloped, it's relatively straightforward to take ownership of that and to sell it in the open market. It will obviously be quite tricky to find buyers right now because the market's on its knees and everybody's selling and there's very few buyers. And it's pretty unlikely that the state-owned enterprises of China will want to do Oaktree a favour and pay top dollar for this piece of land. But seizing an asset in Hong Kong is relatively straightforward. But what is very surprising here is that Oaktree have actually stepped into mainland China, taken control of an unfinished development, and are now managing that whole business. Firstly, that's quite an aggressive step to take in China. Nobody's done this before. And secondly, they didn't really know what the reaction was going to be from Beijing. Now, my read on this goes back to something that we've discussed a lot on this channel. One of the objectives for the authorities in China right now is to try to get all of the unfinished apartments that Evergrande have started and they've taken deposits for, get them finished and give them to the buyers who are waiting. Now, the action that Oaktree have taken is actually consistent with this objective because Oaktree need to get these apartments completed in order to complete the sales and generate some more cash. So basically, Oaktree are doing Evergrande's job for them. They will need to raise any additional finance that's needed to complete this build, and they will be the ones handling the completion process to make sure all of the buyers are happy. So my view on this is that Beijing have taken a view that this is actually acceptable to them because it's just speeding up that completion process. It's one less job for the state-owned enterprises to complete. They may have taken a different view if this was undeveloped land or if it was a completed apartment building. But one other thing worth touching upon here is that the loss of land in Hong Kong has actually caused a problem for Beijing because reportedly they were trying to put together some sort of deal which offered the international bondholders various assets that were sitting outside of mainland China. And the loss of this land in Hong Kong firstly reduces the value of those assets, but secondly also sets the precedent that if any other lender is sitting with security outside of China, they may now follow the same course of action that Oaktree had followed and try to seize those assets and remove them from that portfolio. So that will weaken this whole concept of trying to do a deal with the bondholders and give them all of the non-Chinese assets. If they don't have any non-Chinese assets, then that plan is completely defunct. So what's the summary and conclusion today? Well, the action that we've seen taken by Oaktree is really quite exciting. This is the first time a non-Chinese lender has actually done something about their position, and they've been pretty aggressive about it. They've seized the land in Hong Kong and they've sent people into mainland China to complete the build of the Venice project. So it's great to see something actually happening. Something tangible is going on with the restructuring. We're not just sitting waiting for the risk management committee to tell us it's going to be another 6 months and hang on, we're still thinking about what to do. We're actually seeing somebody step in and do something. And I think this is why Evergrande held their conference call last week and told all of the bondholders to wait and be calm because they're nervous that there's going to be more action taken against more of its assets. Now, there's no public register which discloses how much secured debt is out there. And it's likely that most of the secured debt has been provided by Chinese banks and Chinese lenders who are controlled by Beijing ultimately. So I don't think we will see a lot of aggressive action happening with the Chinese lenders. But if there are more overseas lenders who have security, we may well hear about more action happening over the next few weeks. Oaktree have broken the seal on this. They've been the first movers. And it will be fascinating to see how many other lenders come out of the woodwork. Hopefully this will be the start of a lot of activity and we might start seeing some really fascinating things going on. But I wanted to give you a detailed update today to tell you exactly who Oaktree are, what their thought process is, why they're taking action, why they're able to take action, and how likely it is for other people to follow suit. So the Turkish lira fell by over 40% in 2021. And in the last 3 months of the year, we saw a devaluation of around about 20%. So there is a major crisis going on in Turkey right now. And the government is doing everything they can to try to maintain the value of their currency. A lot of people have asked me, what happens if a currency continues to devalue? And there's a lot of different examples around the world where this has happened. But today I'm going to talk about Zimbabwe, which is an African country that got itself into major difficulties in the late 90s and early 2000s when they had a lot of political unrest. The Zimbabwe dollar was introduced in 1980 when the country changed its name from Rhodesia to Zimbabwe. And due to a variety of different political decisions in the country, inflation started to take off in the early 2000s. Now, this led to a period of hyperinflation where we saw inflation rising at more than 100%. And in fact, at periods, it was over 1,000%. Now, what happens in those circumstances is that the local currency quickly becomes devalued. So the $100 note that you've got in your pocket buys less and less every single day. And that generally means that the bank has to issue more and more notes and that the size of those notes keeps increasing. And there comes a point when you're doing that that you have to then denominate your currency. So in August 2006, Zimbabwe undertook a denomination where it changed all of its banknotes from the old dollars to the new dollars, and the exchange rate was 1,000 to 1. So if you had an old 1,000 Zimbabwe dollar note, it was now worth 1 new Zimbabwe dollar. So even though they'd reset the numbers, the currency was actually worth 1,000 times less than it had been worth previously. And that's basically because inflation was rampant and prices were rising so rapidly that you needed to spend $1,000 to buy something that was actually worth $1. Now, unfortunately, denominating your currency doesn't actually solve the root cause of the problem. The cause of the problem is inflation. And as inflation got more and more out of control in Zimbabwe, then more and more zeros started to be added to the number of dollars that you had to pay for everything. And in July 2008, Zimbabwe undertook a second denomination. And this time there was a massive reduction in the value of the currency. So the exchange rate for the second new Zimbabwe dollar was actually 10 billion to one. So if you had a $10 billion banknote, then you could exchange that for one of the new Zimbabwe dollars. And of course, that didn't solve the inflation problem either. And Zimbabwe holds the record for the largest denominated banknote ever issued. In 2009, the Reserve Bank of Zimbabwe issued a $100 trillion note. 100 trillion. That is one followed by 14 zeros. And at that time, 100 trillion Zimbabwe dollars was enough to buy you a loaf of bread. So the good news at that time was that everybody in Zimbabwe was a trillionaire. But the bad news was that you needed to be a trillionaire just to buy a loaf of bread. So what this story shows you is that when inflation gets out of control and you have to keep paying more and more and more of your local currency to buy goods, then your local currency becomes worthless in the international markets because nobody around the globe wants to buy something that's devaluing that rapidly. So what happened in 2009 was that Zimbabwe abandoned their own currency and moved to using the US dollar. And the problem with doing that is that the central bank then loses all control over its own economy. And one of the other problems is that it's really difficult to reintroduce your currency because nobody has any faith in it. So in 2019, Zimbabwe did reintroduce its own dollar. And at that point, it pegged the Zimbabwe dollar on a one-to-one basis to the US dollar. But unfortunately, the people of Zimbabwe have been reluctant to accept the local currency. The currency is legal tender and is accepted in shops and restaurants. However, you will find there are two different prices and it is much cheaper. And it's much cheaper to buy things using US dollars than it is Zimbabwe dollars. And when people have Zimbabwe dollars, they want to get rid of them as quickly as possible because the value is falling on a daily basis. Inflation is still a major problem in Zimbabwe and was up over 800% in July 2020. And the latest figure reported for January 2022 is 61%. So the ongoing problems that Zimbabwe are facing is that everybody wants to be paid in US dollars, including government workers. So all of your officials who are working for the country want to be paid in dollars. And the problem for the government and the authorities is that they don't have any dollars. Unless a country has a lot of natural resources that the rest of the world needs to buy, it's really difficult to bring in foreign currency. And that's what's happening in Turkey right now. The government of Turkey are desperately trying to source as many dollars as they can, but they don't have anything to offer to bring that in. So they're having to ask the people of Turkey and the companies of Turkey to give them their dollars, and they're having to offer things like citizenship in exchange for foreign currency. So the story of Zimbabwe is a cautionary tale for any countries where inflation is out of control. If you get to the point where your currency becomes worthless and nobody wants it, then it's really difficult to pull that back. And you're then going to have to take on the US dollar, which puts your economy in a very difficult situation going forward. I've talked a lot about SPACs on this channel, and I'm also often asked about what's going on in India. Why don't you cover off any big Indian companies or any tech businesses? And I've now got a story that combines both of these. We are looking at the largest startup coming out of India in the last few years, which is now looking to list in New York through a SPAC merger. Byju's is an online tutoring business that is based in India. And it was established by its founder, Biju Ravindran, in 2011. Now, as you may be aware, education is highly valued in India. And online tutoring is very popular as it's a way of supplementing the standard school day. With a population of 1.4 billion, India represents a huge market. And the founder went out and raised money in the international markets. He got an investment from the Chan Zuckerberg Initiative, which is the philanthropic investment vehicle of Mark Zuckerberg and his wife, Priscilla Chan, as well as a variety of international private equity firms. The business quickly established itself as the largest player in the market and also went around acquiring other competitors to make sure that it was the dominant player. And this is a premium product in India. The basic courses start at $50, which is high compared to the average earnings. But despite this, they have 6 million paying users and the monthly retention rate is over 85%. And of course, the lockdown and the pandemics has been really beneficial for this particular company. A lot of the schools have been closed for long periods of time over the last 18 months. And this has meant that a lot of the population have moved towards Byju's and the online tutoring model. So the company so far has raised over $1 billion and is now looking to list in New York, where it would like to have a valuation of somewhere in the region of $50 billion and to raise around about $4 billion of new money to fund further growth of the business. And as we've discussed before, the easiest and the quickest way to achieve a listing today is to merge your business with a SPAC. And a SPAC is a special purpose acquisition company. And these are essentially cash shells that are listed in New York waiting to merge with something. They're established by entrepreneurs with a track record for delivering deals. And the Byju's deal has got the SPAC community really excited. And there is a bidding war going on right now with all of these guys pitching their ideas and their pricing to Byju's to try to win this transaction. So I've got no idea which SPAC will win this deal. But what I do know is that the share price of the SPAC that announces the merger with Byju's will spike. It will go up significantly upon that announcement. So I thought it'd be interesting to let you know of some of the discussions that are going on right now. Churchill is a SPAC that's been set up by Michael Klein, who's a seasoned professional. And Churchill has teamed up with Lauren Powell Jobs, who is the wife of the late Steve Jobs from Apple. And they've just pitched a proposal to Byju's, whereby apparently Churchill will invest 500 million of the 1 billion that Byju's is looking to raise in its PIPE. And a PIPE is the deal that is done before the merger. It's the acronym for Private Investment in Public Equity. And all companies do this prior to the merger to give them a war chest to be able to pay for all of the marketing and all of the expenses associated with the SPAC deal itself. And apparently alongside that offer, they've also put forward a proposal whereby Byju's can be introduced to both Apple and Microsoft in the US to expand their overseas operations. MSD Acquisition Corp is another of the SPACs that's vying for this deal. And they've apparently come in with an aggressive pricing strategy and are looking at a top-end valuation of $52 billion for Byju's. Screaming Eagle is an amusingly named SPAC who've also come in with an aggressive offer and said that they will match any other transaction. Now, I personally don't like people who operate on that basis because that's not innovative. That's not putting forward a deal. That's just saying, I'll let somebody else do all the work and I'll match it. I don't know why anybody would ever agree to those transactions. Lazy, lazy sort of financing in my view. And the final SPAC that I'm aware of that's in discussions with Byju's is Altimeter, who have their Altimeter Growth 2 SPAC listed right now. And if that name rings a bell, then you may have seen them on the video that I posted on Grab, which is the Southeast Asian version of Uber, that listed in New York through a merger with Altimeter Growth. So as I said, I've got no idea which SPAC will be successful. It could even be another SPAC that I haven't named, but I just wanted to run you through the process to talk about what's happening. So Byju are negotiating now with all of these SPAC guys. And of course, the reason that these SPAC guys are coming in so aggressively is that they hold shares in the SPAC today. So anybody who sets up a SPAC owns all of those shares. And then when you complete the merger with a company like Byju's, the share price will rise from $10 that it's listed at today to who knows what. It could be $50, it could go to $100. So all of the investment that those individuals have in the SPAC right now could increase 5 or 10 times within the next couple of months if they can complete this deal. So they've got a very large personal interest in the transaction right now. So that's why they're coming out and trying to win this deal. They don't really care about the very, very long-term view of what these shares are going to be worth. But interestingly, MSD that I just mentioned, those guys have put forward a proposal whereby they will lock in all of their existing shareholdings for 36 months. So that's basically saying, we're so confident that we think you've got long-term value, we won't sell any of our holdings for the next 3 years. Now, that might just be a negotiating tactic, don't know. But it's interesting to look at how these deals are put together and why the guys behind the SPAC are so keen to find a company to merge with, because basically it guarantees instant wealth for those people. I talked a lot on this channel about energy prices, and the rise in energy prices is one of the main factors for the high levels of inflation all around the world right now. And this week we've seen oil hit $90 a barrel. So the first time in 7 years that we're back up at these astronomical levels, and JP Morgan have forecast that oil could go to $125 a barrel. And the main driver on the rise in oil price is the reduction in supply. And we're also seeing continued rises in coal prices. And the reason for the continued rise in demand for coal is that it's used in a lot of power stations all across the world to generate electricity. Now, as I mentioned at the start of this video, India is one of the early warning countries in terms of what the impact of rising prices will be on an economy. India tends to be a lot more price sensitive than all of the rest of Asia. And in January, we've seen an indication that demand is starting to slacken off in India as a result of these increase in prices. India is the second largest importer of coal in the world after China, and can definitely be seen as the canary in the coal mine here. In the past, India has sourced a lot of its coal from Indonesia, but you may have seen in a recent video that I posted that Indonesia recently introduced a ban on all exports to protect its own coal reserves that were getting low. As a result of this, Australia is now the largest supplier of coal into India, and the price of coal has risen dramatically. In November, the average price was around about $150. In January, that was up to over $260. And the volume of coal that India imported in January was down to 12.4 million tons compared to 16.1 million in November. So quite a marked reduction in the volumes. And as you'll know, if you've been following the recent posts on Turkey, if a country can't afford to keep buying in the raw material that it needs to produce electricity, then that will ultimately cause blackouts in the country and electricity to be switched off. And that has a major impact on industry and exports. So it does have a direct impact on the economy of that country if they can't afford to keep buying in the materials they need to generate power. So that's just a quick heads up, early warning notification. It might be a short-term blip. Prices may start to come back down, but we're not seeing that yet. We're seeing oil prices go higher and higher. Coal prices have continued to go up. Liquefied natural gas prices are also rising. So we're not really seeing any let up in terms of the inflation of energy prices. And at some point, this will cause problems in more and more economies. We've seen it in Turkey already. It's likely that we could see this happening in more countries around the world unless we see a reduction in these prices. Australia is the latest country to announce that it is ending its fiscal support. It's stopping its quantitative easing program. At the end of 2020, the Reserve Bank of Australia started buying $4 billion of bonds in the markets each week. And in total, they're now up to around about $350 billion of issuance over the last 18 months or so. The latest inflation figures show that inflation is now running at 3.5% in Australia, which compares to the target rate of somewhere between 2 and 3%. So it's now at a much higher level than the bank is comfortable with. And in order to try to bring that back down to a manageable level, they've announced that they will be stopping their quantitative easing program. Now, this follows on from similar announcements that we've seen in the US, the UK and Canada. So we're now seeing less fiscal support from all of the big economies around the world, and this will lead to a slowdown in growth, no question about it. The RBA have decided not to increase interest rates yet, so they're still running at 0.1%, an incredibly low level. But as with all of the other developed countries around the world, we will see interest rate increases coming over the next few months in Australia. So the story in all economies around the world right now is the same. We've got high levels of inflation, we've got low interest rates, and we did have a lot of quantitative easing. The quantitative easing has stopped. We're now going to see increasing interest rates. And the key question is, will we see inflation starting to come down? Hi, welcome back to the channel. This video is an update on Evergrande and the property developers in China. And specifically today, I'm looking at some comments that have been made by George Soros. Now, George Soros is a hedge fund billionaire who is incredibly knowledgeable. And he has seen a variety of recessions and dips and double dips and all sorts of crises. And he's come out and talked about the developers in China and the unsustainable model that the whole country has built. And he's talked about what's going on with the local governments. And he's made some comments about President Xi Jinping's position. And he's also made comments recently about BlackRock, who recently raised a $1 billion mainland China fund. So I'm going to run through what George Soros has said and look at the specifics of what he's identified as the risks, because a lot of this is building on what we've already discussed on the channel. But I think he's made some really good points that are absolutely relevant for what is going to happen in China over the next 3 to 6 months. And this isn't going to be contained to just the property sector. We're going to see a much bigger impact on the whole Chinese economy. So before we get into all of that, if I could ask you to give me a thumbs up at some point during this video, if you're enjoying the content, and please subscribe if you haven't done so already. And if you've got time, pop a comment in the boxes below. And just to remind you that I include chapters in my videos. So if there's a section that you're not that interested in, it's really easy to skip through it and move on to the next topic. George Soros is a 91-year-old US national who was born in Hungary in 1930. He had to live through the Nazi occupation of Budapest. After that, he moved to London where he studied his degree, and he then moved into banking. He established one of the first ever hedge funds in 1969 called Double Eagle. And a year later, he created the Soros Fund. Now, the term legend is bandied around far too often these days, but George Soros is a genuine legend in the world of finance. And his philosophy was to focus on the fundamentals and look at the economics of the situation. And in 1992, he was dubbed as the man who broke the Bank of England when he bet heavily against sterling. At that time, the UK had joined the exchange rate mechanism, which was an early stage version of the euro. And in that mechanism, every single currency was pegged at a particular rate against all the other currencies. And George Soros identified the fact that he thought that sterling had been pegged at far too high a level compared to the other nations. So he started shorting sterling. He started selling sterling in the markets, and he took a $10 billion position, which was a pretty big bet compared to the size of his fund at that point. But it paid dividends as the UK faced the option of either hiking its interest rates dramatically or leaving the exchange rate mechanism, which it did. And that caused sterling to crash. And George Soros made over $1 billion profit on that deal. Later in the 90s, he took similar positions against the Malaysian ringgit and the Thai baht. He's currently estimated to have a net worth of around about $9 billion. However, he's very philanthropic and is reported to have given away $32 billion of his wealth. He's no longer involved directly in the fund management business, which means that he has free rein to say what he likes about anything at all in the world. And that's what's great about the comments that he's made about Evergrande and the Chinese economy, because he doesn't have a vested interest. He's not looking to pump the market and try to move sentiment. He's just saying it as he sees it. And that's why I think it's really valuable and interesting to go through exactly what he's been saying about Evergrande and the Chinese property development market and the Chinese economy as a whole. So in George Soros's speech at Stanford University this week, he said that the model on which the real estate boom is based is unsustainable. People buying apartments have to start paying for them even before they are built. So the system is built on credit. And he went on to say that the people of China had been encouraged to invest the bulk of their life savings into property. Now, he's made some really great points there that really underline why there's such a big problem in China right now. And I think the key issue to focus in on here is really the fact that a lot of the purchase price for apartments in China is paid up front. We've heard stories of people paying up to 100%. So in the rest of the world, you do pay a deposit. So if you want to buy an apartment, you will have to put down some cash. But generally speaking, that's usually about 5 or 10% of the purchase price. So it's affordable. It's usually part of the deposit that you've saved up that you put alongside your mortgage. So if you're taking a 75% mortgage, you generally have a 25% nest egg, and therefore you could afford to put 5 or 10% up front. If you're paying 50, 60, 70 or 100% up front, then that genuinely is taking you into a position where you're having to put all of your savings into an unfinished apartment. And that really highlights the risk profile of what we're talking about here and why the sector is in such difficulty. We've talked about it a lot before, but Evergrande have taken money from 1.6 million people in China. So those 1.6 million have given over their life savings to Evergrande in the belief that this was a rock solid investment, that Evergrande were trustworthy, they would build the flat and they would hand it over to them and everything would be fine. And the position that all of those people find themselves in now is that Evergrande has not completed the build of their apartment. They're in huge financial difficulty, so they're at risk of going bankrupt. And that means that those people's life savings is now at risk. That money has gone. It's not been escrowed. It's not set aside and can be returned to those individuals. It's been used by Evergrande. And the problem we've got here is that Evergrande does not have the cash to complete the builds to hand those apartments over to those buyers. And that's why we're seeing the government stepping in and arranging for the state-owned enterprises to buy the assets from Evergrande so that they can be completed and then given over to those buyers. So Soros's statement about the whole system being built on credit is absolutely right. He's hit the nail on the head here. And the problem that we've got is that the credit is now being withdrawn. So the property developers have been using credit heavily to grow their businesses. So they used debt to buy the land, they used debt to build the apartments, and now that all of that debt has been withdrawn, they can't finish what they started. So they've got a lot of unfinished building sites and they've got a lot of land on which they can't even start those projects. And we're now starting to see that whole system unwind. So George Soros is absolutely right when he says that this model is unsustainable. The only way it could have carried on is if the authorities were happy to let the debt grow and grow and grow exponentially. But there was always going to come a breaking point when the debt couldn't be extended any further. And that's where we are right now. And we're only just starting to see the unwinding of all of these problems. I touched on it on a recent video, but a lot of the suppliers to the property development sector are now starting to post losses and are taking legal action against Evergrande and all the other developers. And the reason for that is that they haven't been paid and they're now going bust. And the domino effect from that is massive because those suppliers won't pay their suppliers and they won't be paying their staff and those staff won't be spending in the economy. And you've got the downward spiral that you see in an economy when it is shrinking. So the unsustainable model that's highlighted by George Soros is no more. It can't continue. The debt just isn't there. They can't keep feeding that model. And now we're going to see the whole thing start to collapse. Another really great point that George Soros made was about local governments. And he said that local governments derive most of their revenue from selling land at ever rising prices. In China, there are monthly auctions of land held by all of the local governments. And for the last 5 to 10 years, these have been a huge profit center for all of those local governments. There's been an ever increasing demand for land and the prices have continued to go up and up and up. So each month they release more and more land, all the developers borrow more debt to buy that land and everyone's a winner. So these land sales have been a license to print money for all of the local authorities. But unfortunately, the wheel has now stopped turning. And as the bank debt was switched off to the property developers, that meant that they could no longer buy any more land. The monthly land auctions are now reporting a huge fall in the volume of transactions and also the value of the land being sold. And this again highlights the fact that the problems will not just be contained to property developers. We're now seeing the local authorities suffering. They've been relying upon this source of income to pay all of their staff and to continue doing everything that they do. And now that that source of income has been cut off, then they are facing a shortfall and losses. And as I reported in a recent video, local government financing vehicles have been set up and have been borrowing debt aggressively. So the local authorities also have a huge amount of debt. In the video, I highlighted that it's estimated to be $8 trillion, which makes the property developer position look relatively small. And when you take a step back and look what's happening, the whole system is a deck of cards because it started with the debt being provided to the property developers who could then start spending more on land. And we saw aggressive auctions because the property development companies were outbidding each other. They were using more debt to beat the other guys with a higher price. And so everything got bid up, and that meant the local authorities had more money and they could then spend more money and they could then borrow more money themselves. So the whole thing started building up into a hugely inflated bubble. And now that we've seen that bubble burst, everything is going to come collapsing back down again really quickly. And George Soros has also made some interesting statements about President Xi Jinping. In an article, he referred to the president as the most dangerous enemy of open societies in the world. And he believes that Xi Jinping faces opposition within the Communist Party for the upcoming elections. And in terms of his management of the property development crisis, he said that he believes that they may have postponed dealing with it for too long because people's confidence has now been shaken. So it remains to be seen how the authorities will handle the crisis. Xi Jinping has many tools available to re-establish confidence. The question is whether he will use them properly. And he believes that falling prices will turn many of those who invested the bulk of their savings in real estate against Xi Jinping and that the situation doesn't look promising. So a really interesting perspective. And one that we haven't really discussed much on this channel is what will happen if we see a change of leadership. Now, I know that it's a single party rule in China and we're just talking about the change of president. But the president does have a big influence on what goes on in the country. And Xi Jinping has been following his common prosperity for all policy. And this policy has led to the three red lines being introduced and the reduction in the amount of debt available to property developers. So that really is the root cause of where we are right now. So if we were to see a change of president, there is a possibility that we could see a change of philosophy, that we could see a tweak to the way things are done going forward. And that would be really interesting because where we're sitting right now, I think we've all got good visibility as to what might happen. We know that the government has taken over Evergrande and is now stepping in and buying up all of the valuable assets from all of the developers in difficulty. So everything's being nationalised. All of the unbuilt apartments will be completed and given to the population. And we will see a collapse of all of the businesses that are left behind. So we know exactly where we're going right now. But if there was a change of leadership in April, then that could be right in the heart of when we're seeing everything starting to tumble down. So a change of plan at that point could really throw a whole new set of ideas and a whole new set of risks into the equation. So Soros has highlighted this as a potential issue. I think Soros is probably right because Xi Jinping is going for a third term in office, which hasn't been done before. So there is a chance that he won't get re-elected, that somebody else could get put into power. And particularly if everything starts to collapse really quickly over the next couple of months, just before the election. So that's the worst case scenario for him. It's the best case scenario for anybody who wants his job. And then they will need to come in and address what's going on in the property sector. And it could be that they try and introduce some radical new ideas. So really interesting thought, really interesting idea, and something that I'm sure we'll cover again in future videos. While we're on the issue of China and George Soros, I wanted to touch on BlackRock. Now, BlackRock, well, the first fund manager who've been allowed to launch a mutual fundraise in China. They got approval from the Chinese authorities and they now have their inaugural Chinese fund. And back in the summer of 2021, they raised just over $1 billion from 111,000 Chinese investors. And BlackRock have also stated their intention to invest more of their existing funds into Chinese businesses. And George Soros has spoken out about this and said, "Pouring billions of dollars into China now is a tragic mistake. It is likely to lose money for BlackRock's clients and, more important, will damage the national security interests of the US and other democracies." He went on to say that BlackRock has drawn a distinction between the country's state-owned enterprises and privately owned companies that is far from reality. So quite damning words from George Soros in respect of the BlackRock moves into China. He's clearly pessimistic about the long-term prospects of any investments in China. But what he said about private and state-owned entities is exactly right. So BlackRock's belief is that there is a difference between anything that's state-owned and the private sector. So they're looking at the private sector in China being very similar to the rest of the capitalist world. But what we're seeing with Evergrande and the other developers is that that differential doesn't really exist. Once the private company gets itself into difficulty, the state can step in and do what it likes. So we've seen with Evergrande that the risk management committee was set up and all of the members of the risk management committee are the government officials. So Evergrande was essentially nationalized without the government having to actually buy it back from investors. They just sent their guys in and they're now running the company and they're breaking it up piecemeal. So they're using the state-owned companies to buy all of the valuable assets from Evergrande and the other developers at an agreed price. So what that tells you is that the differential between state-owned and private doesn't really exist if the company gets into difficulty. They will change the rules and send in their own people. So I think George Soros has a point when he says that there isn't really that differential. BlackRock's view is probably incorrect. And his view about whether or not BlackRock will make money in the long term in China, well, that remains to be seen. But from what we're seeing right now and where we are with regards to the Chinese economy, it looks highly risky to be putting any money into China at this point in the cycle. So what's the summary and conclusion today? Well, George Soros, as I said earlier, is an absolute legend. I've got a lot of time for his thoughts and methodology and the way he goes about doing business. He looks at the fundamentals with any business and then he makes a call as to what's going to happen. And this guy has been proven right a lot of times in the past. If you're a self-made billionaire, then you've got to be doing something right. And he's been operating in the world of finance and economics for a very long time. So when he comes out and makes statements such as he has about China, it's worth listening to what he says and looking at the facts of what he's basing his opinion on. I think his assessment of the business model being unsustainable for property in China is absolutely correct. And I also think the fact that it was based upon credit and now all of the people are starting to suffer because they have put a disproportionate amount of their savings into this single asset. And that is fundamentally going to be a problem for everybody in China. It won't just be the property developers who suffer. We're seeing an impact on the local governments as well because they've been feeding off this market for a very long time. And we're also going to see all of those individuals who put their life savings in having financial difficulties. So this is contagion right the way through the whole of China. So his viewpoint with regards to BlackRock potentially facing losses in China also has some substance, because when you look at where we are in the cycle, it doesn't look like the right time to be making heavy bets on China right now. Hi, welcome back to the channel. This video is another update on Turkey. If you've been following my recent videos, you'll know that we've been looking at what's been going on with the Turkish lira, which is really important to Turkey as they are a net importer at the moment. They have to import a lot of their raw materials and goods before they're processed and then exported. So the Turkish lira value is really important to the Turkish economy. And if you've been following the situation, you'll know that in December, the Turkish lira devalued significantly. And the central bank in Turkey had to step in and support the lira in the currency markets. And it's now trading at somewhere around about the mid
13 lira to $1 range. And it's been pretty stable for the whole of January. So we saw the value whipsaw around in December. And I'm being asked a lot of questions from everybody saying, how come the Turkish lira is now so stable? And there's been a lot of people saying, we don't think that the Turkish economy is in difficulty because look what's happening with the lira. So in this video, I wanted to go through exactly what is going on with the lira. I've got some data that I think shows what's really going on with the lira. I don't think it's just stabilised in the international markets by its own accord. I think there's actually some support being given to it. But we'll go through the information. So in this video, I'll talk to you about intervention. What intervention is and why countries intervene to support the value of their currency. We'll have a look at what's happened to the Turkish lira in the past and the redenomination of the currency that took place in 2005. We'll look at what happened to the currency in December and the level of support that the Turkish Central Bank had to provide to maintain the value of the currency. And then we'll look at what's happened in January, and I'll show you some data that I think reveals exactly what is going on with the Turkish lira right now. And then finally, I'll wrap up with a summary as to what I think is likely to happen over the next 3 to 6 months and why the value of the Turkish lira is so critical to the Turkish economy and what is likely to happen over the course of 2022. So before we get into all of that, if I could ask you to give me a thumbs up at some point during this video if you're enjoying the content, and please subscribe if you haven't done so already. And remember that I always include chapters in my videos, so it's really easy to skip through a section if you're not particularly interested in that. And for regular viewers, I just wanted to let you know that I've changed my microphone for this video. So previously I've been wearing a lapel microphone on here, but today I'm working with one of these microphones. Not sponsored, not trying to promote the product, just letting you know what's going on with regards to the production. The aim of the currency markets is to set a relative value between all of the currencies in the world so that you know what your currency is worth compared to others. So the most common example is the US dollar. That's the benchmark currency that most countries look to see how the value of their currency is trading in the international markets. And the strength of a currency will depend upon a variety of factors, including interest rates in that country, the political situation in that country, and the level of demand for raw materials and other products coming out of that country. So generally speaking, if you're a country that produces something that the rest of the world needs to buy, such as oil, and you've got a stable political environment, and your interest rates are at a stable level, then your currency should be strong in the international markets. Because when people want to buy the oil that you're selling, it means that they will have to convert their own currency into your currency, and therefore your currency should be in demand and remain at a relatively high level. However, if you're a country that's a net importer and you don't have any valuable raw materials or goods to sell to the rest of the world, then you have to work with other mechanisms to try to keep your currency stable, such as interest rates and a stable political environment. So if we take the example of Turkey, Turkey does not have an abundance of natural resources that the rest of the world wants to buy. So therefore, it's a net importer. It has to import raw materials and unfinished goods, which it then manufactures and produces and exports out to the rest of the world. So there's no strong driver for other nations to be buying the Turkish lira. So Turkey therefore depends upon a stable political environment and interest rates that are attractive to the rest of the world. Now, as you'll know if you watch the channel, interest rates are very closely linked to inflation. And inflation has been running at a high level in Turkey for quite a long time now. And that's meant that interest rates are also very high. Now, in normal circumstances, high interest rates would attract in investors, and therefore there would be demand for the Turkish lira, and that should keep the exchange rate relatively stable. However, there is a tipping point, and once interest rates go beyond a certain level, everybody is cautious about hyperinflation and the fact that the economy could be running away with itself, and therefore we could see the value of the currency starting to fall. And that's what's been happening with Turkey over the last couple of years. Interest rates have been above 20%, and that's a warning sign to investors all around the world that something isn't right in Turkey. As I've discussed a lot on this channel, the usual way to deal with high inflation is to increase interest rates, because that calms spending and therefore demand goes down, and therefore you should see prices starting to come back down rather than going up. Now, Turkey have taken a contrarian view of the world, and in September, they decided to start reducing interest rates, even though inflation was increasing rapidly. And that combination of rising inflation and falling interest rates led to a huge fall in the value of the Turkish lira in the international markets. And in order to stop the falling value, the Central Bank of Turkey had to perform an intervention. An intervention is basically when the central bank of a particular nation steps into the international currency markets and starts buying its own currency using foreign currency. And the reason they did that is based on simple economics. The currency markets are a pure market. It's all about supply and demand. And if you have all supply and no demand, then a price will fall because nobody's buying, everybody's selling, and therefore the price keeps going down. So until somebody starts buying that currency, the price will just keep falling and falling and falling. And that's what the Turkish Central Bank did in December. They became a buyer in the international markets of Turkish lira, and they used their US dollar reserves to do that. So an intervention is simply when a country decides to buy its own currency. Nobody else wants to buy it, and therefore they step in and start buying it and artificially keep the price at a certain level. So why would you undertake an intervention in the currency markets? Well, there's a variety of reasons for doing so. And Turkey did this in December to try to stabilize where the lira was trading. And they wanted to do that because they are a net importer. So it's really important to the economy of Turkey to ensure that the Turkish lira has good value in the markets. They have to buy in a lot of goods, and they also have to buy in a lot of energy. So we've talked about it a lot on this channel, that they have to buy natural gas to feed their power stations and also to feed the network of households that use it for heating and cooking. They have to make those purchases in US dollars because that's the market for energy, and therefore they need the Turkish lira to have a good exchange rate against the dollar. Otherwise, those purchases become more and more expensive and put a lot more pressure onto Turkey. So there's a good economic reason for trying to maintain the value of your currency. And the main driver for making an intervention is to stop the run on the currency. So if the price is going down and down and down, you want to put a stop to that. And then the next step beyond that is to solve the problem that caused this position. So if it's a short-term measure that you can fix, then it makes sense to make an intervention, stop the run on the price, and then fix the problem and carry on as you were. So it's broadly comparable to when we see the price of a share suddenly spiking or plummeting on the stock markets, and the stock market then suspends that share because they want to know what's going on. Why is that price suddenly moving dramatically? They suspend the share and then give the company time to either make an announcement or for something to happen so that the price can then stabilize. So we do see this sort of thing happening in lots of different markets. But the problem that we've got with the Turkish intervention in December is that it wasn't caused by a short-term blip. This wasn't because of rumours in the market or somebody trying to short the Turkish lira and then causing a run on the currency. This was caused because the Turkish authorities decided to start cutting their interest rates at a time when inflation was moving to a 10-year high. So there was a fundamental cause of the fall in value of the lira. And that cause has not been fixed. So stepping in and making an intervention in December did stop the price falling below a certain level, but it didn't solve the problem as to why that price had got so low. So the key question remains, why has the Turkish lira stabilized and remained trading at around about 13, 13 and a half lira to the dollar when the fundamentals remain exactly the same as they were in mid-December when we saw the value fall dramatically? So I wanted to touch briefly on what happened back in 2005 when the Turkish lira was redenominated. Now, the original Turkish lira dates back to 1923. And following World War II, in 1946, it was pegged against the US dollar at a rate of 2.8 lira to $1. Now, over the decades, that rate deteriorated. And by the 1980s, we were looking at an exchange rate of around about 80 lira to $1. By 1990, it had got to 2,500 lira to $1. By 1995, it was $43,000 to $1. By 2000, it was $620,000 to $1. By 2001, it was $1.25 million to $1. And by 2005, it got up to $1.35 million to $1. And the Turkish lira had the unwanted accolade of being recorded in the Guinness Book of World Records as the least valuable currency in the world. In 1995, 96, 99, 2000, 2001, 2002, 2003 and 2004. So the decision was taken to redenominate the currency and the Turkish authorities introduced the new Turkish lira. So the international symbol for the new lira is TRY versus the old lira, which was just a single T. And the redenomination was 1 million to 1. So one new Turkish lira, TRY, was worth 1 million old Turkish lira, the T. And at the point when they introduced the new Turkish lira, the rate to the US dollar was 1.344 lira to $1. Now that rate has deteriorated over time, but in the first 13 years of the new Turkish lira, it was a relatively slow deterioration. And by 2018, the rate was 4.8 Turkish lira to $1. Now, since 2018, we have seen a rapid deterioration in the new Turkish lira, and that has been accentuated over the past few months. So let's have a look at what's happened to the value of the Turkish lira over the last few months. And the starting point for this analysis will be on the 24th of September, which is when the Turkish Central Bank cut interest rates from 19% to 18%. So this was the start of the new policy that focused in on reducing interest rates at a time of very high inflation. So that was a surprise to the international markets. So we saw after the 24th of September, when the Turkish lira was trading at around about 8.9 to the dollar, it started to fall in value and it rose above 9. And then on the 22nd of October, the Turkish Central Bank announced that it was cutting interest rates further to 16%. So they dropped another 2%. And we can see in November it started to move towards 10 to 1. And then on the 19th of November, the Turkish Central Bank cut the rate again to 15%. So we'd gone from 19% to 15% in the space of 2 months. And that really sent a message to the market that Turkey was serious about this strategy of continuing to reduce interest rates at a time of extremely high inflation. And that's when the value of the Turkish lira really fell like a stone. So we can see that through November, it got into double digits. And as we went into December, it started to get weaker and weaker. And on the 17th of December, the Turkish Central Bank announced that it was reducing its rate again to 14%. And that's when the value hit its all-time low on this chart of 16.4 to $1. So at that point, it looked like the value of the Turkish lira was going to keep falling dramatically. There didn't seem to be an end in sight. However, at that point, the Turkish Central Bank stepped in and made an intervention. Now, initially, it was reported that they spent $7 billion buying lira in the international markets to try to improve the exchange rate. And we can see that it did work. And the exchange rate then came back down to around about 11 lira to the dollar. However, after the intervention, we can see that the rate then shot back up to over 13 to 1. And that's where it's remained through January. However, as an update, the data that we've seen for December shows that the Turkish Central Bank sold nearly $20 billion in foreign reserves in December to support the currency. So the initial estimate of $7 billion was a lot less than what they actually invested into the markets to support the Turkish lira. It's almost 3 times that amount. And that's really the root cause of why the foreign reserves are now so low and why Turkey is facing a currency crisis. So looking at the exchange rate graph between lira and US dollars, it looks like the Turkish lira has stabilized quite nicely in January and is trading now at a range somewhere between 13 and 14 lira to the dollar. But why is that? Why has the lira suddenly stabilized when all of the fundamentals are still negative. We've still got very high inflation. In fact, the latest inflation figures that have just come out show that we're now at a 20-year high for Turkish inflation. We've still got falling interest rates, and the Turkish Central Bank have made it clear that they're maintaining that strategy. They will carry on reducing interest rates. And we've also got a lot of other issues going on in the Turkish economy, such as the trade deficit, the need to keep buying gas, and so on. So it seems counterintuitive that the Turkish lira has now stabilized against the dollar. And the information that we've seen indicates that Turkey is still intervening in the currency markets, but they're not announcing any of these interventions to the world. So it appears that in the last week of January, the Turkish Central Bank spent around $1 billion stabilizing the currency. And this situation is what's referred to as a managed exchange rate, or dirty float in colloquial terms, which means that the central bank is continuing to buy Turkish lira in the currency markets to maintain that value at somewhere around about 13 to 1. Now, the Turkish Central Bank has not formally announced any market interventions since mid-December, and the governor is denying making any interventions and said that no intervention took place on December the 20th, despite the fact that the value of the lira moved from around 16 to 1 to 11 to 1 over the course of a couple of days, which seems unbelievable as nobody else was buying lira in the markets at that point. So what's the summary and conclusion today? Well, clearly the value of the Turkish lira in the international markets is really important for the Turkish economy. Turkey is a net importer. It has to buy in goods, but it also has to buy in energy. And it can't stop buying that energy. There is no option of not buying in natural gas to keep the fire stations creating electricity for the whole of the country, and also for the gas to be used in homes for heating and cooking, and by industry. And one of the biggest exporters in Turkey is iron and steel. And those industries use a lot of gas in their processes. So the value of the lira is clearly very important to the Turkish Central Bank, and that's why they made interventions in the market in December. But the level of stability that we've seen in January indicates that those interventions have continued throughout the course of this year. Now, the Turkish Central Bank hasn't announced any formal interventions, but it just doesn't make sense for the Turkish lira to suddenly stabilize. The fundamentals are still the same. We're still looking at extremely high levels of inflation. We're still looking at reducing interest rates. And the combination of those two factors doesn't tell the international markets that we've now got a stable situation in Turkey. What it says is that we're going against everybody's normal beliefs that when you've got high inflation, you should increase rates, and we're going to reduce them. So potentially reducing rates can fuel spending even further and drive up inflation faster. And when you've got high levels of inflation and falling interest rates, that means that your currency is not attractive to international buyers. And because Turkey doesn't have a lot of raw materials and natural resources, there is no drive to buy the Turkish lira. So when you look at the big picture, the Turkish lira should still be falling in value. And it looks like the main reason that it isn't is because the Turkish Central Bank are continuing with their intervention policy, but they're just not announcing any of that to the international markets. Now, as I said at the start of this video, it can make sense to make an intervention if there's a short-term blip. If something happens which is moving the price on a short-term basis, then it does make sense to spend some money stabilizing your currency and wait for that to pass. But that's not the situation here. What we've got is long-term fundamentals which are driving down the value of the lira. And if the Turkish bank is making interventions, then it's artificially keeping that price high. Now, that can't go on forever because Turkey is short of currency and it needs that currency to buy natural gas to keep electricity and industry and homes fed. So there's an impending crisis here. We're looking at the foreign currency reserves getting dangerously low. We're seeing the central bank pulling as many levers as they can to get more currency in. So they've asked the population to hand over all of their currency. They've asked all of the industry to hand over a lot of their currency. And they're offering citizenship to people from foreign countries in order to get some more foreign currency in the bank. But at some point, those reserves are going to run out. And once that happens, then we've got a real problem for Turkey. Because firstly, the currency is going to devalue further. So if they stop making any interventions, then we'll have an open market on the Turkish lira. And as there's very little drive to buy Turkish lira right now, we could see the value really fall dramatically. But more importantly, we're going to see Turkey being unable to carry on buying in natural gas. And if that happens, then we will see more blackouts and we will see the lack of supply to industry and homes starting to hurt exports and starting to cause real problems with the population of Turkey who won't be able to heat their homes or do any cooking. So there is a real crisis here. And in this video, I've covered off what happened to the Turkish lira between 1946 and 2005, when the original Turkish lira was denominated. And there is a genuine risk here that if the value of the new Turkish lira suddenly starts to plummet in the international markets, then Turkey could be facing a second redenomination of its currency. So I will keep you posted on what's happening in Turkey, what's happening to the currency, as soon as there's any further news. Hopefully you've enjoyed the content of this video. If you did, then please give me a thumbs up. If you haven't subscribed, then please do so already. And if you've got any comments on this video, any of my other videos, or the new mic that I'm using today, then please pop it down below and I'll try to respond to as many as I can.